The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, I'm Gino Geraci. Great to be with you. This week, after the House passes the Equality Act, we'll look at hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
In the name of inclusivity, you'll have made life far less safe, far less fair, and far less inclusive for America's women and girls.
Albert Mohler explains why this legislation is so ominous.
There is no religious liberty if the Equality Act, as it is currently written, is adopted into law.
We'll look at the $1.9 trillion COVID aid bill.
$1.9 trillion ostensibly for coronavirus-related costs, but only about 10% of the total bill goes for that purpose. The rest is pork barrel bailouts for the states that have mismanaged this crisis.
All this and more. I'm Gino Geraci, your host this week, coming to you from my home station, 94.7 FM The Word in Denver, where I host Crosswalk each weekday afternoon. You can hear my own program on 94.7 FM and 94.7FMTheWord.com. Take a moment to follow Christian Outlook on Twitter at TC Outlook. That's TC Outlook. Great to be with you. Late last month, the Equality Act passed in the House of Representatives by a 224-206 margin. It was largely a party line vote. Now, this bill is before the Senate, a Senate, you'll remember, controlled by the narrowest of margins by Democrats. The Judiciary Committee held hearings on the bill this week. Before that hearing was Abigail Schreier. She's the author of Irreversible Damage, the transgender craze seducing our daughters. She's also a courageous voice on a contentious subject today. Here's Schreier before the Judiciary Committee.
Members of the committee, if your daughter or granddaughter was the top high school tennis player in her state, and then five biological boys suddenly decided at the age of 17 to identify as female, should she drop overnight to number six? Should she lose her college scholarship to a male-bodied athlete who would never have qualified on the boys' team? Does that strike any member of this committee as fair or just? If a woman in your state commits a crime, should she be put in a correctional facility with biological males, some of whom are sex offenders, some of whom may have only begun identifying as female weeks earlier, all of whom could easily overpower her? If a preschool has a policy that only female teachers may accompany little girls to the bathroom, and your daughter's male teacher suddenly identifies as female, ought that teacher to have a legal entitlement to accompany her? Does that strike anyone in this room as safe or sensible? Should a female abuse survivor at a domestic violence shelter be forced to sleep and undress next to a biological male? The plain truth is that it is not sensible, not safe, and certainly not just to end these hard-won protections for women and girls in the name of equality. For some girls, athletics is the only chance they'll have to shine for the entire course of their lives. But supporters of this bill don't appear concerned about them. They are concerned about the progressive groups that will call you a transphobe or a homophobe if you don't do exactly as they say and abandon women and girls. By enshrining gender identity as a protected category, this bill would make it impossible ever to legally distinguish between a woman and a biological male who claims a female identity for whatever amount of time and for whatever reason or purpose. And gender identity can be very ephemeral. Even prominent gender therapists attest that people can be on a gender journey and identify as one thing one day and another the next. They have that freedom in America. Should we undermine women's sports and protective spaces to allow gender-fluid males a gender journey? Just last week, after the Washington Correctional Center for Women began housing prisoners according to gender identity, half a dozen men transferred into the women's prison. One of the inmates raped a female in the women's prison upon arrival. If you pass this bill, you can expect hundreds more victims like this one. And that has nothing to do with transgender people and everything to do with opportunistic self-identification by violent male felons. I have probably interviewed more transgender Americans than any person in this room. And I can honestly say that, excepting political activists, most do not want to obliterate women's rights and safe spaces. Most would never think of stealing women's scholarships by forcing young women into demoralizing contests with male bodies. But gender ideology, which is at the heart of this bill, is misogyny and progressive clothing. Gender ideology tells women and girls that they are not entitled to their fear or their sense of unfairness as their protective spaces are eliminated. They must never object that sports is and has always been a matter of biology, not identity. They mustn't assert that we keep women's protective spaces for biological women to ensure their physical safety regardless of how they identify, because it isn't our identities that are at risk. It's our bodily integrity. Being a woman is a lifetime commitment. It entails profound blessings, but also physical vulnerabilities. For generations, women like the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg fought to create sex-based protections to make life safe and fair for women. If you vote to take away those rights, don't pretend you've achieved a civil rights victory. In the name of inclusivity, you'll have made life far less safe, far less fair, and far less inclusive for America's women and girls. Thank you.
In follow-up, Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton provided an example of how this would impact sports.
Let me ask one final topic in closing, just to make this concrete, Ms. Schreier. Do you know who holds the women's world record in the 100-meter and the 200-meter dashes?
I believe it's Allison Felix.
It's the late, great Florence Griffith Joyner. Lo Joe, to millions of her fans, one of the most exciting, dynamic, amazing athletes I've seen in my lifetime. I can remember watching her set those records now 33 years ago. The fastest woman to ever run in recorded history. No woman has ever run faster than Flo Jo. You know who has run faster than Flo Jo? 76 high school boys in America in 2019 alone. High school boys, not grown men, and just in America, not all around the world. Ms. Schreier, is it really fair to allow biological men to compete against women in sports if 76 high school boys can run faster than the fastest woman in the history of the world?
No, it is not. It would end women's sports.
There's no question, if this misnamed Equality Act were to be signed into law, it would dramatically impact the world of sport. But it would also dramatically impact religious liberty. You don't have to trust us on this. The lead sponsor of the bill has admitted as much. Albert Mueller explains from his briefing program.
This time, the lead sponsor of the Equality Act in the House is Representative David Cicilline, a Democrat of Rhode Island. He made the statement quite confident of the passage of the Equality Act and notice his logic, quote, "This is going to be a vote that's going to be remembered in the history books, and I think people are going to want to be on the right side of history," end quote. How many times have you heard that thus far? But I really want to direct our urgent attention to a comment that Congressman Cicilline made when he was asked if this Equality Act would represent a challenge to religious liberty and to religious institutions. He said this, and I quote, "The determination would have to be made as to whether or not the decisions they are making are connected to their religious teachings and to their core functions as a religious organization, or is it a pretext to discriminate," end quote. Now, just pause for a moment. If you haven't heard anything else I've said, just understand what this congressman said. He said straightforwardly that if this act passed, some agent of government, some bureaucrat, some regulator, some judge, or some legislator, for instance, is going to have to make the determination as to whether or not a religious institution is making a bona fide religious claim based upon legitimate religious conviction in order to be understood as operating on the basis of some kind of legitimate religious liberty, or if it is simply using religious liberty as, in his words, a pretext to discriminate, end quote. Now, I am unaware, to be honest, of any precedent in this in the entirety of American history. I cannot imagine that in any previous epoch you would have a member of the United States Congress dare to say that the legislation he has sponsored would put the government in the position of deciding whether or not, for example, a Christian college is actually operating on the basis of Christian conviction in its admission or hiring or student conduct regulations or student housing arrangements, or if it's just exercising some kind of pretext to discriminate. Sometimes you hear exaggerated language out there when it comes to threats from legislation or court decisions, but let's be clear. If the government, government regulators, government agents get to decide when a Christian institution is actually operating on the basis of legitimate Christian teaching, then religious liberty is completely dead. Religious liberty disappears if the state is going to tell Christians what Christianity is. There is no religious liberty if the state tells the Jewish people what Judaism is, if the Muslim people are told an official government understanding of the teaching of the Quran. You go down the list, there is no religious liberty if the Equality Act, as it is currently written, is adopted into law. Here's where we need to understand another danger. The other danger is that there will be some members of the United States Senate who will try to claim that they made some accommodations to religious liberty, but here's what we need to note. They are likely to be extremely minimal because those pushing the Equality Act don't believe they have to make any concessions. And furthermore, even if they are more substantial, they are likely to be temporary. And here's the pattern you need to watch. Congress makes adjustments in order to meet some kind of public expectation for the protection of liberty. Congress then comes back in a later time to review and revise the legislation, but it does so outside of the public eye without that kind of public attention. And it comes back and does eventually what members of Congress planned to do in the beginning, but they couldn't get away with it in the beginning. They'll get away with it in the end. That's their confidence. After all, Representative Cicilline has already put us on notice that he, and not we, is on the right side of history. So in my experience working on these issues for decades in American public life and in Christian leadership, I have to say that I want to put two statements alongside one another to recognize our current situation of peril when it comes to religious liberty. First of all, go back to the oral arguments and to the statement in the Obergefell case in which the Solicitor General of the United States said it will be an issue. But in this case, the second statement that just came from Representative Cicilline in recent days about the Equality Act, the second statement is this: the determination will have to be made. Well, those are chilling words. Those are words that tell us that the government is now poised, by the very instigation of Representative Cicilline, to tell Christian organizations what Christianity is and to judge whether or not we are legitimately Christian or just merely discriminatory. This is an act, let's recall, that now threatens to basically undermine and effectively abolish a constitutional right, that is a right that is preserved and respected in the very beginning of the United States Constitution and its Bill of Rights, and instead to replace it with a new set of rights that basically come down to those letters LGBTQ. And don't forget the plus sign. There's more coming.
Coming up, a $1.9 trillion aid package.
Only about 10% of the total bill goes for that purpose. The rest is pork barrel.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Gino Geraci. A week ago Thursday, President Biden signed the $1.9 trillion COVID aid bill, a measure they've called the American Rescue Plan. Some of you may have already started receiving stimulus checks, but there's far more to this bill and what this bill signals than those direct payments. I turned to Lawrence W. Reed of the Foundation for Economic Education.
I was wondering, Lawrence Reed, if you've ever entertained the notion of writing a new book about have we become socialists? It's my understanding, unless my math is wrong, will this upcoming legislation be not one, not two, but three $1.9 trillion bailouts? And what does that actually mean? Is this a way of redistributing wealth, or is the money that they've printed, is that really wealth that's being redistributed?
Yeah, the legislation you're referring to really ought to shock Americans to their very core, because it is an unfathomable figure, second biggest bill in American history, and with the larger one being just a year ago or less. And it's $1.9 trillion ostensibly for coronavirus-related costs, but only about 10% of the total bill goes for that purpose. The rest is pork barrel. It's bailouts for the states, especially the states that have mismanaged this crisis. It's just shocking, and the sheer size of it is something that Americans ought to be shaking their heads at. And it comes on the heels of the most dramatic increase in the nation's money supply in the past year that we've seen in 70 years, 26%.
Now, you're an economist both by training and by trade, and as you think about what's happening, what is Lawrence Reed thinking about as he sees this bill pass? What does that actually mean to our country and our future?
Well, there's a big difference quite often in economics between the short term and the long term. And in the short run, you know, some people are going to get some relief, but a lot of people and a lot of local and state governments that probably shouldn't get a bailout are going to get some, quote, relief, too. And a lot of recipients of pork barrel spending are going to really like it. And it may give the economy in the short run what appears to be a kind of a lift, but there's always another side to this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's what really concerns me. The longer term, which may be, you know, a year or more, not very far into the future at all, I think we're going to see much higher price inflation. We're going to see a day of reckoning in the form of a correction. It could be a very substantial one. And certainly future generations are going to be bearing the burden of paying this bill that we are running up in the current day.
Now, as you've been thinking about what's been going on for the last 12 months, we've had a coronavirus, we've had a COVID pandemic, there seems to be a growing, dare I use the term, a growing, not just tolerance, but acceptance of socialism. So we understand a little bit about philosophical Marxism, and then you have what some people are calling this other new worldview that seems to be emerging, ideological social justice, where it seems to be an evil stepchild of cultural Marxism. And what do you see happening in the broadest sense of what's happening with the way people think about governance?
Well, unfortunately, you know, we used to be a people that came together with a broad consensus on a lot of things, but this thrust toward ever bigger government has produced a very divisive culture. It always does. I mean, you go back to the declining days of the Roman Republic, and you'll find that there, too, faction was fighting against faction. Everybody was crawling over each other, trying to get in charge of the massive redistributive apparatus of the state. Socialism breeds conflict. It breeds division. It lives off of it. And socialists are constantly pitting one class against another, rich versus poor, employers versus employees. I mean, they eat, sleep, and drink conflict and strife. All the more reason, in my view, for people to wake up and realize that society is hurtling towards disaster, economically, morally, spiritually, in every sense. And it's time to do something about it.
Lawrence, you've written prolifically and even persuasively that socialism doesn't work. It's never worked. It's always ended badly. And off the air, we were talking about the socialism experiments in Russia, China, North Korea, North Vietnam, Venezuela. Has there ever been historically a country that seemed and again, Haiti's bent to embrace socialism. And there was a reversal. There was something where a group of people woke up and they said, socialism is not for me, and they were able to turn it around.
Yes, several that I can tell you about, Gino, within our lifetimes. Back in the 1980s, New Zealand mm-hmm. was a welfare state. It was high tax. It was all kinds of economic interventionism, high tariffs. They were a basket case mm-hmm. in the world. But over a two-year period in the mid-80s, they completely unwound that. They had one of the biggest reductions in the size of the public sector as a portion of the economy that any country has seen in the last century. And now New Zealand, all these years later, is considerably free and, in fact, most recently rated the second freest economy in the world.
Wow. Now, based on those examples that you've just given, why do you think so many people are swallowing the socialist pill?
In a lot of cases, people are getting it, especially young people, in the schools and universities.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how many times I've run into young people who say that their teachers told them socialism is caring and giving and sharing and so forth, when, of course, you get more caring, sharing, and giving under capitalism than you ever get under socialism. So people aren't, for the most part, being told that beneath the velvet glove is the iron fist. Socialism ultimately rests upon the use of force, the concentration of power. And in spite of all the promises that it's going to take care of you and do this and that for you, it comes down to one word, force. If it's voluntary, it's not socialism.
Why is it important for socialists or progressives to conscript Jesus as part of their narrative in trying to sell an ideology that is not just corrupt, but it's insidious. It actually is destructive. It's the exact opposite of human flourishing.
Yeah, and to further the irony, so many socialists are not Bible scholars. They don't read the Bible very frequently, and they ultimately want to put the state where God should be, and they hope that you'll worship that state as opposed to the Creator. So I think it's a marketing technique. They understand that if they can conscript Jesus or superimpose their philosophy onto him, well, there's a whole lot of people in the world, 1 to 2 billion right off the bat, at least, who will immediately perk up and say, well, if Jesus was one, maybe I should be one too. So it's a marketing technique more than anything else with no accuracy to the claim whatever.
Coming up, Tim Keller after his diagnosis with pancreatic cancer.
The joys of my day are much more satisfying than they used to be.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Gino Geraci. Tim Keller is a name and a voice familiar to many of you. He's also a prolific author of numerous Christian books, including The Meaning of Marriage. He's the founding pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City, retiring that role in 2017. And in June last year, he announced he has pancreatic cancer. He wrote about his journey in a recent piece in The Atlantic, Growing My Faith in the Face of Death. He and his wife, Kathy, talked about it with John and Kathy on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
Tim, in the article that you wrote for The Atlantic, you were talking about the love that we have for things of this world and how the more that we try to grasp onto them, the more we find that they just fall through our fingers and they don't even satisfy as much as we think that they might. And as an example of that, you talked about you and Kathy on vacation. Mm-hmm. Can you tell our listeners about that, how you both approached vacation and kind of in thinking about it, what that revealed about the two of you?
Yeah, and that's just one. It's a good example, I think, but there's a million of them. Basically, Kathy, because I worked so much and because work was so exhausting and draining, she lived for our getaway times, just lived for them. when at the beach or you know, near, in the mountains or those places. And we had places we went every year, and we had a pretty good number of weeks, especially as I got older, I was able to get more time. And she lived for them, but so much so that as soon as she got there, she knew, oh my goodness, in 2 weeks we're going to be gone. Mm-hmm. And wasn't ever able to completely enjoy it because she was looking to it to basically make everything okay in our lives. I tend to do the same thing with work. I tended to say, if I could just get this one thing done, if I could get this project done, this thing done, this book written, boy, then I'll finally be on top. I'll really feel like I've arrived and done everything that God wants me to do. And of course, that's actually a kind of idolatry as well. And you're looking to something in this world to sort of make everything okay, and nothing will. So when you look at it like that, I didn't enjoy my vacations because I was spending all my time thinking about what I was going to do when I got home. Kathy didn't enjoy them because she knew that they'd be over soon. And we realized now, once the cancer thing came in, we may never go to those places again, by the way, or we, you know, at least not much. Or
we're hoping.
Never.
We're hoping to go to the beach this summer, but it won't be the same.
But right. And also, I've certainly died to all kinds of ideas on projects and things. And surprisingly, we're realizing we're just actually enjoying every day more. We're enjoying just the way things look, mm-hmm. just the way things. I just love the joys of my day are much more satisfying than they used to be. And Kathy's
the Puritans. The Puritans had a word for it. They called it being weaned from the world. And any mother who has weaned a child who was nursing knows that the child doesn't want to be weaned. And you cannot say, honey, there's pizza, there's chocolate, there's hamburgers. You just have no clue what you can branch out into if we finish with this part of your life.
Right.
I think being weaned from the world is the same way. I love my stuff. I love my house. I like the way my bedroom is and my furniture. It's old, it's shabby, but it's what I want. And yet I need to be weaned away from it and think of the glories and the joy of heaven. The first person that Tim ever did a funeral for in Hopewell was named Alice Longman. Do you want to tell this story, Tim, or do you want me to tell it?
It's Alice Lockton. Alice Longman is Trevor's
I'm so sorry.
Wife.
Yes, Alice Longman's Trevor's wife. Sorry, Alice. Alice Lockton.
Oh, Trevor joins us.
Was in the,
we just talked
in
to Trevor a couple
home.
Days ago.
She was in the nursing home. She was blind. All of her children had died. Her husband had died. All of her friends had died. She couldn't watch TV. She couldn't read. She couldn't garden. None of the things that ever gave her happiness were open to her anymore. And she said, I'm just so grateful to God. Because when I get to heaven, he's the only thing I'm going to have, and he's getting me ready for that. That's God's mercy. I mean, God has the most wonderful judo moves that he has done on our behalf. Death is supposed to be a curse. It is a curse. But he's mm-hmm. flipped it so that it forces us to think about the eternal things that we would just put off until it was too late. So he turns even the curse of death into something that forces us to come to him.
But Kathy and I keep saying, when you get to 70, you really shouldn't be, you really should be realistic. The time is short. The more we wean our hearts from the world, the easier it's getting to say, Lord, thou knowest, whatever your will is good and perfect.
And in the interim, of course, I'm sure your family's closed ranks and your children and your grandchildren are always within arm's reach, probably.
When you're in your 70s, the time is short and you have your grandchildren. And the youngest ones you're likely not to see grow into adulthood. And so you really do need to pour as much of you in. Mm-hmm. Grandparents can do certain things that nobody else can do. And I think we have to make sure we do them as long as we're here.
Coming up.
Hell is, it's a divine judgment, but it's also kind of in line with the trajectory of sin.
Eternal separation from God when the Christian outlook returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Gino Geraci. Hell, It's a subject we wrestle with often, or perhaps we seek to avoid wrestling with. The determined unbeliever bristles at what is seen as such an arcane notion, but is still haunted by it. The Christian, at least the Orthodox Christian, accepts it, but often wrestles with it nonetheless. Pastor Gavin Ortland asked in a recent YouTube piece, "Does hell make sense?" He talked about it on the ride home with John and Kathy.
I wonder if we've really been able to retain any of the truth of the doctrine of it. How do you look at that?
Well, when I was growing up, this was a major struggle for me. When I was in college, I had lots of friends who were non-Christians and just grappling with the sadness of it was sort of overwhelming. And then also just facing objections to it and kind of feeling like, wow, I can understand how someone could look at this and it could seem so terrible and harsh. Like, how could I believe in this? And I've gotten to a point where I've kind of felt more peace. Now I can understand this better. But I think it took working through some caricatures that I had. And I think
cultural caricatures?
I think so. And I would say perhaps even in the church as well. I'm sure I'm not the only one who thought of hell as a kind of torture chamber when I was a kid, that God builds this dark, fiery torture chamber. And that's where he sends people. And it's a tricky thing because we don't want to take away from the seriousness of hell. You know, we don't want to make it sound like it's not a bad, scary place. But I think the way people understand that sometimes is arbitrary, as though God just decides to do this. And I think what C.S. Lewis has helped me think about is that it is an understandable idea if you think that God is the source of everything good. And so if you're banished from God's presence, you could say sort of like, what could it be but hell? Mm-hmm. And that's helped me think, not that it's taken away all the struggles or the sadness of it, but it's helped me understand why it kind of makes sense.
So hell as the absence of God in many ways. And Gavin, you've talked about this. You say that all reality is pulling in two opposite directions. So every choice that we make, essentially, is a decision between heaven and hell.
Yes, that's what's helped me think about this. If you think of God as the source of all that is good, and you say, well, people are ultimately designed. We have a soul. We're headed somewhere. We're ultimately designed to be united with God, to live in his presence. As followers of Jesus, we believe that's what Jesus came to do, to restore us to God, to reconcile our relationship with him. But ultimately, for every human being, that either will happen or it won't happen. And so when you think about that, it becomes the Christian view of the sort of end, final state of things is like this ultimate pulling apart, like C.S. Lewis called it the great divorce. This final, you know, there's God, and if you get God, you can't not be fully happy and fully alive because of who God is. But if you're banished from God, you can't have any happiness because where would it come from? You know, God is the source of all good. And so that has helped me make more sense of this, that this isn't arbitrary. It's not like God just said, well, of all the options for the afterlife, let's make them heaven and hell. You know, it's like, no, it couldn't be anything but that because of who God is.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's just land on The Great Divorce for just a minute, which for those of you listening is a book by C.S. Lewis, if you're not familiar. One of the things that kind of helped me to put it in context were the actual people that he introduced. And it made me see that the destiny of the person is like, it's an individual thing. It's not like a pronouncement on a group, as it is like the hell is personal and different. You know what I mean? Someone's hell is different than someone else's hell.
Yes, I'm the exact same way. And also heaven being very personal.
Yes, exactly.
And yes, and it makes it feel less arbitrary because it's not just this building that in the underworld or something that God sends people to. But what C.S. Lewis helps me think about too with that is the seriousness of our moral choices. You know, for people listening to this who maybe have doubts about this, you know, one of the appeals that I would make is whatever else you say about the Christian way of looking at things, it really gives dignity to the choices we make every day, because the Christian faith is saying that these choices we make every day, either toward the light, toward God, or toward the darkness, away from God, that's doing something that can last forever. You know, we can be, if we're getting more and more stuck in our envy, in our anger, mm-hmm. you know, that's serious. Whereas if you don't believe in an afterlife, it's, you know.
So what's the matter?
So it helps us to take, you know, and for the question of, well, why would anyone not choose heaven? It helps us when we think about, well, we can see this choice playing out right now. All of us have had times in our life where probably we can admit, yeah, I didn't take the joyful path. It was too humbling. It was too hard. I was fine to stick within my own little darkness. But the gospel does give us hope, of course, as well. So I know we'll talk about that.
Mm-hmm. So, Gavin, in the piece that you did on YouTube, Does Hell Make Sense, which, you know, we're amplifying here, you tell a really interesting story about Tim Keller. Could you please repeat that for our audience?
Yes, certainly. Yes, Tim Keller is talking with a person in his office, and Tim Keller, of course, ministering in Manhattan, where there's many skeptics who have objections to things like hell. And this particular person said they really couldn't take seriously the Bible's fire and brimstone type language, and they just thought it was kind of silly. And so he read him some of C.S. Lewis. Hell begins with a grumbling mood, you know, always ungrateful, never satisfied. And he introduces this idea that we've touched on a little bit here, that hell is, it's a divine judgment, but it's also kind of in line with the trajectory of sin and the trajectory of evil. And so he's talking about how, you know, one way to think about hell is when God just says, okay, if you want to run the other direction, okay. And you're stuck with yourself, kind of a thing. And he said that the man got very quiet and said, that scares me to death. Mm. And it helped me think about, you know, sometimes I think we need to scare people with the fire and brimstone language. And I want to be careful about that because I want to honor the language of Scripture. I'm not saying we shouldn't use that language or something, but it is helpful to know that sometimes what people might find most scary is this more subtle way of thinking about it as well, which I think is not necessarily at odds with that language, mm-hmm. but it's also another layer on top to consider, that it is terrifying to think of being left all to yourself and your resentments and your unforgiveness or whatever it is that we struggle with to think. And that's, of course, why the gospel is such good news. It's the gospel is something external to our lives, the grace of God coming in, you know, ushering us towards something we could never have discovered on our own.
Coming up, the settling of the issue.
When I look at Jesus hanging on the cross, I say, a God who can do that, I can trust.
A few more minutes on hell when the Christian Outlook continues.
Before I spoke a word, you were singing over me.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Gino Geraci. There's no escaping the fact that hell is not the most enticing subject for casual conversation. But the hope and the comfort that we have in the face of hell's reality is found in what Christ, in fact, has done for us, for those who have put their trust in Him. If you're in Christ, there's no need to fear hell. You can say with Paul, "Oh, death, where is your sting?" Here's a few more minutes of Pastor Gavin Ortland with John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
You know, thinking about objections and certainly things that I've considered on my own and struggled with is the idea that, well, if God is so loving, then how could He possibly, you know, send somebody to hell? You brought up Tim Keller. We were just talking to Tim and Kathy last week on the show, and his article in The Atlantic that he wrote about death is just really excellent and really honest and thought-provoking. But one of the things he says in there is that, you know, if there's a God who we can explain, or a God whose judgments we understand, then He's not much of a God because He's just like me, right? So like, that's no good news for anybody. That applies to judgment too. And that applies to hell too. You know, every time I think, you know, we've talked about the Ravi Zacharias story, you know, 30 times in the last 2 months. And I keep coming back to the fact that there is a perfect judge. There is one. Mm-hmm. And even when things are not adjudicated fairly on earth, which most of the time they're not, even if people suffer with untold injustices, there is a judge, and He is a good judge. So talk about that. I mean, the character of God and recognizing that His reasoning is bigger than ours has to figure in.
Yes, I think so. And I read the same Tim Keller article and appreciated it so much. And his emphasis on this has helped me a lot. Yeah. If my faith never really challenged me or even made me concerned and angry at times, it bothered me at times, I'd know that it's not the truth. Just like any relationship, you know, if it's any real relationship will change you over time as slowly you kind of see things that you never could have seen otherwise. And I agree with what you're saying and what Tim Keller has said, that the human heart does long for justice and for judgment when we really see evil. We all have a sense that, you know, a good God is not just going to be like a Santa Claus type figure who's just blessing people perpetually and never judging people. But what ultimately helps me think about this topic, of course, is the cross, where we believe Jesus himself, God incarnate, was judged in our place. And when I look at that, the way I ultimately land the plane on this, because I'll be honest, all this is helpful to talk about, but ultimately it doesn't necessarily take all of my struggles away.
Right.
But when I look at Jesus hanging on the cross, I say, a God who can do that, I can trust. Mm-hmm. I may not have all my questions answered, but if that's the clearest revelation of the heart of God, one who would die for his enemies, one who says, Father, forgive them for they know not what they do. Okay, I'm all in with that. Mm-hmm. I can trust a God who does that, even if I don't have all my questions answered.
That wraps up this edition of The Christian Outlook. If you enjoyed the show, tell a friend about our program. Send them to thechristianoutlook.com. Encourage them to subscribe to our podcast. It was a pleasure being with you today. Thanks for joining us. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin, producers David Pichon, Mike Cook, Alex Perez, Mark Howington, I'm Gino Geraci. Be sure to join us again next time for The Christian Outlook. But it flew away from her reach, so she ran away in her sleep.